The title of the sermon is, in fact, Europe in Biblical Prophecy. And I did talk about the beast already last time when I spoke to you, and of course I've given a standing watch program which goes into this also in more detail. But just to refresh your recollection, we have several scriptures in the book of Revelation which talk about beasts. In Revelation 13, actually, there are two beasts mentioned. In Revelation 17, there is one beast mentioned. But those beasts are quite different from each other, and we have to understand that we are not talking about the same thing. There is a beast described in Revelation 17, in verses 12 to 14, which I like to turn to. And that beast is a scarlet-colored beast and a fallen woman, a harlot, a prostitute, a whore, however you want to call it, is sitting on that beast. That beast has seven heads and 10 horns. I'd like to focus right now on the 10 horns. It says in Revelation 17, beginning in verse 12, "The 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. And these are of one mind, and they will give their power and authority to the beast." Verse 14, "These will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are called, chosen, and faithful." What to take from the scripture is that these 10 kings, these 10 horns, these 10 kingdoms, because the words for king and kingdoms can be used interchangeably, will exist at the time of Christ's return. They will exist together with the beast, in this case a military economic leader, and they will fight together against Jesus Christ. Now these 10 kings are also mentioned in Daniel chapter 2. And again, these will all exist at the same time. Daniel chapter 2 and in verse 44. It says, "In the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever." The same scenario is being explained here. Those 10 kings or kingdoms, here they are referred to as 10 toes of a statue, will fight against Christ, will lose. Christ will come to destroy them. Now, we have just read in Revelation 17, verse 12, that these kings will obtain power for 1 hour. That is a very short time. They will receive it for 1 hour to share it, turn it over to that charismatic, political, military, economic leader, who is also called the beast. And we have just said, and we have just explained, that they are going to fight against Christ. But the beast will also be accompanied by another figure called the false prophet, a religious figure. We've always felt that that would be the Pope, whoever is going to be the Pope at that time. It's interesting that the current Pope might not live much longer. He's been in the hospital with complications. Every day we find out another development. Whether the next pope is the one, we'll have to see. But there's going to be another pope, that's for sure. It's not going to be this one. We have been talking about core Europe for quite a while. The idea being that you have the United States of Europe, if you please, a European superpower, consisting right now of 27 member states. We've always felt that the 27 member states are not going to be able to run Europe because they're all divided amongst themselves. But ultimately, there's going to be 10 nations or groups of nations coming out of that European unity, not developing apart from them, coming out of, because they're part of the beast. But they will then run Europe, and they will then pass on their authority to the beasts. In the last Standing Watch program, I did quote an article again from Bild Online, dated February 20, and I'd like to just read one section from that article because it was quite interesting. It says, "More important, we need a major European plan for our security, and therefore also for the security of Ukraine, whose soldiers ensure that the Russian army does not come any closer to us. We need something that we ourselves never thought we were capable of. If not all European partners want to participate, then individual states will have to join forces." Another way of putting it, Europe in with two speeds, core Europe. The Bible says 10 nations or groups of nations will come together. They will join forces. And then the article says, "We need preparations now. It's about our security, our freedom, our lives." More and more, Germany and certain countries in Europe understand that they cannot rely on the United States of America anymore when it comes to security. They have to have their own army, and they are going to have their own army. But we also need to remember, I alluded to this last time, that there's going to be a merger between church and state. There has been a merger before, a collaboration between church and state. And when I talk about church, I'm talking about the Catholic Church and its denominations under it. And when I'm talking about state, I'm talking about the European states. In the end time, that will be even more a strong merger, a collaboration, where sometimes the borders between the two are fluent. I'd like to turn back to the book of Daniel, chapter 7. In Daniel, chapter 7, and beginning in verse 7, we read about a beast. Most commentaries understand that this is a description of the Roman Empire in existence at the time. And this fourth beast, which is being described here, is quite unusual because there is more to it than just a normal beast in that sense, because in Daniel chapter 7 and in verse 7 we read, "After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. Now these 10 horns are consecutive horns, referring to one horn following the other. So therefore, it's not the same as what we read in Revelation 17. But it goes on to say, "And I was considering the horns, and there was another horn, a little one, coming up among them, before whom three of the first horns were plucked out by the roots. And there in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking pompous words." And when you keep reading, you find that this little horn is intending to change times and seasons, laws and seasons, laws and times. In other words, the law about God's holy days. And at the end of this vision here, we read that it's clearly now referring to the end time. So this little horn would come up, it would plug out three horns, about which we are going to talk about in a moment, will become bigger and bigger, and then it will exist in the end time. And notice what it's going to do in Daniel 7 and in verse 24. "The 10 horns are 10 kings who shall arise from this kingdom, one after the other," is the idea. "And then another shall arise after them in their likeness, having the same kind of governmental structure. He shall be different from the first ones. He shall subdue 3 kings, so 3 horns will be plucked out. He shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, shall intend to change times and law, and the saints shall be given into his hands." How long? "For a time, times and half a time." 3.5 years. Talking about the very end time. So this is talking about the little horn. And you guessed it, it's talking about the Catholic Church, which is becoming extremely powerful again in the end time. But then the interesting thing is, you can also read something about another little horn. Now, why would this other person now also refer to as a little horn? Because he is. It's not the same. Daniel 7 talks about the religious aspect. This one I'm going to read to you now is going to talk about the military aspect. In Daniel 8, verses 8 and 9. And here we're talking about the kingdom of Alexander the Great. And Alexander would die, and his kingdom would be given to four generals. And you read that in verse 8. Therefore the male goat grew very great, but when he became strong, the large horn was broken, and in place of it four notable ones came up towards the four winds of heaven. But notice verse 9. And out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great towards the south, towards the east, towards the glorious land. And notice verse 11. And he even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Antiochus Epiphanes, who came out of this concept regarding those generals, did exactly that. He actually invaded Jerusalem, the temple. He sacrificed swine's blood on the altar, and he did away with the daily sacrifices. He set up the abomination of desolation. But this was a forerunner only, because Christ would later say, in the end time, something like that would happen again. And we'll talk about that in a moment as to how that is to be understood. But my point is this. Go to the end time. Let's go to verse 23 of Daniel 8. And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their fullness, a king shall arise, having fierce features, who understands sinister schemes. And his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He shall destroy fearfully and shall prosper and thrive. He shall destroy the mighty and also the holy people. And on it goes, talking about the beast, the final beast person who's going to do all of that. He's also referred to the little horn. So you have a collaboration here between the little horn of the Catholic Church and the little horn of the beast power, the final charismatic political leader. Because the Bible sometimes doesn't make a distinction. It's all the same in that they all work together. You can't separate them. When you go back to Revelation 13, there you find this beast with also seven heads and ten horns. But there the ten horns also talk about ten consecutive revivals of the ancient Roman Empire, all happening in Europe, because that's where these empires resided and existed. Now these seven heads are different from the seven heads of the beast in Revelation 17. In Revelation 13, it talks about all the previous rules and governments and empires coming together. The Babylonian Empire, Greco-Macedonian Empire, Median Empire, and then the Roman Empire. So you have seven heads because the Greco-Macedonian Empire had four heads with the four generals. And then out of that, there would be ten revivals. In Revelation 17, however, as we will see, those seven heads are different. Because, you see, the woman never rode the beast when it came to the first three horns. These first three horns would be plucked out by the little horn. And so the woman would only ride on the last seven revivals of the Roman Empire. So let's talk about the revivals a little bit, because people don't seem to understand what Revelation 17, Revelation 13, and Daniel 7, and Daniel 2, and all these passages are actually telling us. I'm saying this because we're getting these comments now to the Standing Watch programs, which we are allowing to be made, and some people are just confused. Oh, well, this is just interpretation, and oh, this is not happening, and it'll never happen, and so on. Well, the Bible makes it very clear. Let's talk about them. Let's talk about the ten revivals of the ancient Roman Empire. You see, Rome fell. Rome fell when it came to the Caesars, I mean the Roman emperors. That fell. And then it would be slowly revived. And first, it would be revived through barbarians, as we call them, or Germanic tribes. But you see, even there, people are confused when it comes to Germanic tribes, and people say, oh, Germanic tribes, this means Germans. No, it doesn't mean that at all. Germans, yes, they were part of the Germanic tribes, but the Germanic tribes don't only consist out of Germans, see? It's all confused. We are talking about the first revival of the ancient Roman Empire. And that happened under Genseric. The name was Genseric. He was the king of the Vandals. He revived it. Genseric was of the Arian faith. It was a different faith than the Catholic Church's faith. The Arian faith, for instance, rejected the Trinity. Didn't believe in the Trinity. Had other ideas they didn't accept when it came to the Roman Catholic Church. Of course, they also had errors on their own. But you see, this is a point. So the first revival was done by a barbarian tribe which did not have the same religion as the Roman Catholic Church. When it came to the second revival, that is when the Heruli entered Italy, and their ruler was Odoacer. And he himself assumed the title of King of Italy. You guessed it, he also was of the Arian faith, not the Roman Catholic faith. And then he was assassinated. Nothing new under the sun. They killed him. And so the second revival of the ancient Roman Empire ended, but it gave way to the third revival under King Theodoric of the Ostrogoths, a Germanic tribe, but not Germans, right? So here comes King Theodoric. And he marched into Italy, established himself as the actual ruler of Italy. And yes, he also was of Arian faith. And so here you have the three revivals. And they were all of Arian faith, of a faith opposed to the Catholic Church. And the Catholic Church opposed the Arian faith. And they opposed those three leaders, those three revivals. We also read in the Bible, in Revelation 13, that the Roman Empire received a deadly wound, but that deadly wound was healed. It was healed under Justinian in 554 AD, and this is looked upon and explained as the imperial restoration, because Justinian, who was actually in the eastern part of the Roman Empire, marched into Rome, took over Rome, and thereby combined the eastern and western parts, I should say, of the Roman Empire. Now, he was not of Arian faith. He was a Catholic. And so the stage of world history was set for the fourth revival of the ancient Roman Empire. Justinian the First is also referred to as Justinian the Great. He ruled from 527 to 565, and during his rule, he sought to revive the empire's greatness and reconquer the lost western half of the classic Roman Empire. Now, here's where it's becoming important for us. At the beginning of his reign, Justinian deemed it proper to promulgate the law, or rather, promulgate the law by the church's belief in the Trinity. And he threatened all heretics, everybody who didn't believe in the Trinity, that they would be punished. And he subsequently declared that he intended to deprive all disturbers of orthodoxy of the opportunity for such offense by due process of law. This is called the Code of Justinian. It enacted Orthodox Christianity into law. And when I say Orthodox Christianity, I mean the belief of the Roman Catholic Church. It acknowledged the ecclesiastical leadership of the Roman Church and ordered all Christian groups to submit to her authority. Relapsed heretics were to be put to death. And other dissenters were to suffer confiscation of their goods, and I'm quoting now from a historical book. They were declared incompetent to buy and to sell, to inherit or bequeath. They were excluded from public office, forbidden to meet, disqualified from suing Orthodox Christians for debts. So those who were not Orthodox Catholics were forbidden from buying or selling. That should ring a bell when we're thinking about the mark of the beast, prohibiting to buy or to sell, or rather, you have to have it in order to be able to buy or to sell. The mark of the beast then began at the latest with Justinian. The idea it's only coming up in the end time is nonsense. It existed at least since Justinian. It describes the political, economic, religious, and military support of the rule of the Babylonian system of the Holy Roman Empire with its human concepts in opposition to the truth of God. Of course, it has a lot to do with the Sabbath. It has a lot to do with the fact that either you choose the Sabbath or you choose the mark of the beast, i.e. Sunday. Sunday worship and the worship of pagan holidays like Christmas and Easter and the rejection of God's holy days, annual holy days. But it goes further than that. It talks about a whole system, a whole concept, a whole idea. And it's interesting, the number 666, which is also the number of a man, as we know, is also the number of a concept where man is opposed to God. The number 3, the number of man opposed to God, thing of the Trinity, is being mentioned here numerous times. 2 times 3, plus 2 times 3, plus 2 times 3, 666. All of this goes hand in hand. So, the first 3 Arian revivals had been plucked out by the little horn, representing, of course, the Roman Catholic religion. We have just read that. And beginning with Justinian, but not before that, a close connection and collaboration between the Roman Catholic Church and the Roman state would continue and would last with intervals and interruptions until the return of Jesus Christ. The first 3 revivals of Rome were a thorn in the flesh of the Catholic religion. But the last 7 revivals, beginning with Justinian, are pictured in the Bible as the fallen woman riding and sitting on the beast. Remember now, that fallen woman didn't ride on the first 3 revivals, but it would ride on the last 7, the 7 horns of the beast in Revelation 17. It would ride on that one. And this close collaboration between the military power and the religious power would continue until Christ would return. One more comment. The imperial restoration, which happened in 554 under Justinian, when the deadly wound was healed, how did it occur? It occurred under the leadership of Roman popes, especially Pope Pelagius, and to a lesser extent, previous Pope Vigilius. They were behind it. They also got to his wife, who was a strong Catholic, and they all were working together to get Justinian to march into Rome, take over, become the emperor of Rome. That brings me to the 5th revival. The 5th revival under Charles the Great, Charlemagne, Karl der Große. Now, historians consider him as the greatest European ruler of all time. Even Napoleon, Kaiser Wilhelm, admitted that they dreamt of being another Charlemagne. He wiped out, he killed, he slaughtered, he destroyed all the pagan Saxons unless they became Christians. A terrible slaughter took place under him. And he subdued everybody and forced them to accept Christianity, his concept of Christianity, the Holy Roman Catholic Church's Christianity, as he explained it. He was crowned by Emperor Pope Leo III in 800 AD. He is considered by many scholars as a father of the Holy Roman Empire. Why holy? Well, because now we had this very close collaboration between church and state. The 6th revival occurred under Otto the Great. And he ruled as the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation from 962. He received the title Imperator et Augustus. Augustus going back to that Roman Caesar, so to speak. Augustus. We come back to Augustus in a moment too. So he revived clearly the ancient Roman Empire under the Caesars, under the Roman emperors. And under his rule, Germany became the greatest nation in Europe in the 10th century. And then you had the 7th revival under Charles V of Habsburg. And we should not dismiss the Habsburgs because they're still around. His son is still around. Otto von Habsburg's son is still around, making some interesting comments recently about the future of Europe. So he was crowned, Charles V, in 1530 by Pope Clement VII as the Holy Roman Emperor. And it says that Germany could speak again with its former authority in Europe, as it had done under Otto the Great. Charles V ruled over an empire which never saw the setting of the sun. We have a statement in Germany to that effect. You see, if the sun would set in the west, people living there, it would rise in the east and you would see people living there. So his empire was so great that the sun would never set over his empire. The Habsburgs opposed the Reformation under Martin Luther, made every attempt to destroy it. In the territory of Austria, they were almost completely successful in preventing the new movement from gaining a foothold. Internally, the Habsburg consolidated their rule and reestablished the supremacy of the Roman Catholic Church. And of course, the Habsburgs, even today, are still very strong Catholics. Then we come to the 8th revival under Napoleon. Now, not only the French, but also more and more Europeans saw the empire of Napoleon I as a continuation of the Roman Empire. Even and especially Germans supported and accepted the French emperor. And he wrote in 1806, he wrote in French, I'm not trying to say it in French, because we have people here who speak French, but in English it would say, I am Charlemagne. He believed that he was a reincarnation of Charlemagne. Others actually believed that too. But he specifically pointed that out. And the Catholic Church again became the official church of France after his coronation through the Pope in 1804. He crowned himself again in 1806, this time with the celebrated Iron Crown of Lombardy, one of the great historic symbols of Europe. The crown had previously been worn by Charlemagne and Otto the Great, for example. Now, Napoleon fell in 1814. That is when he was forced to finally abdicate. And so the system of the Roman-inspired government, which was first resurrected by Justinian in 554, came to an end after exactly 1,260 years, from 554 to 1814. Why is that interesting? Well, let's turn to me, or with me, rather, to an interesting passage in Revelation chapter 13 and in verse 5. Revelation 13 and verse 5, where we read about the revivals of the ancient Roman Empire. And in Revelation 13 and verse 5, we read, "And he was given a mouth, speaking great things, and blasphemies, and he was given authority to continue for 42 months, or 1,260 days first, but in prophecy many times a day stands for a year, so we're talking about 1,260 years, exactly the time from the healing of the deadly wound until the time when Napoleon resigned. But something else would be happening during this time, during these 1,260 years, in Revelation chapter 12 and verse 6. In Revelation 12 and verse 6, we read about the church. Not the end-time church here. We're talking about the history of the church here. And in chapter 12 and verse 6 we read, "And then the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God, that they should feed her there 1,260 days or years in biblical prophecy." So while the Roman Empire ruled since the beginning of Justinian all the way up until Napoleon, the church would be protected. It wouldn't die out. Many attempts were made, it appears, to wipe it out. For instance, we do believe that, for instance, the Church of God was represented at a time by the Waldenses, and the Catholic Church was willing to eradicate them, but they were not quite successful because God would protect them. God would see to it that they would survive exactly during this time. But now two more revivals would happen, and the next one would happen under Benito Mussolini, Il Duce, and Adolf Hitler. Mussolini had a dream. He dreamt of a new Roman Empire led to the conquest, and that dream led to the conquest of Ethiopia. In 1935 and 1936, he invaded Ethiopia, took it over. And following Italy's defeat of Ethiopia, Mussolini now proclaimed that another resurrection of the Roman Empire had taken place. He said in 1934, "After the Rome of the Caesars, after that of the popes, today there is a new Rome, fascist Rome." Mussolini's recreation of the Roman Empire was commemorated by the monumental construction of the Via del Impero. Still can look at that. The Pope praised Mussolini as a man whom Providence gave us. Mussolini was worshipped as a god. His ministers were his high priests. He dreams of Rome as a metropolis as it existed during the times of Emperor Augustus. Now, we have heard about Augustus before. So the idea is like to recreate and reestablish the ancient Roman Empire under the Roman emperors. Il Duce was, during his glorious days, more popular, a commentary says, than anyone before or after him in the modern history of Italy. Now, it's an interesting passage we read in Revelation 17, verses 10 to 11. There we read in Revelation 17, verse 10, "These are also seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. And the beast that was and is not," and then goes on to say, "is himself also the eighth," and so on. We'll talk about that aspect later. Here right now I want to talk about the fact that it says, one have fallen, or five have fallen, one is, the other has not yet to come. And then it says, the beast that was and is not. So we have understood this in the past very clearly in this way. When Mr. Armstrong understood the meaning of this verse, at that time, five revivals of the ancient Roman Empire, the Holy Roman Empire, had ceased to exist. He understood it at the time when Mussolini and Hitler were in power, but the problem was that was a comparatively speaking minor, unimportant revivals when you compare it with the past revivals and when you compare it with the future revival, which is to come. So therefore, the Bible is saying here, well, it is and it really isn't. In other words, yes, five had fallen, one is, but it really isn't, and another one is still to come. And then we'll talk about that it's being the eighth out of the seven. We'll come about that, talk about that in a moment. So that is definitely one way of explaining this passage, because we should understand that the Bible is written for us today and for the end time generation, and that we should be able to understand more and more what these scriptures mean. So let's talk about the one which is still to come, which is coming right now, the 10th revival of the Roman Empire, the 7th revival of the Holy Roman Empire. Now, let me just say that I have taken some of what I'm talking today about from our two booklets, Europe and Prophecy, and also the 10 European revivals of the ancient Roman Empire. And we say in those booklets that in the sense, the Roman Church has been influencing the European unification process to a certain degree all along. The Telegraph wrote in 1991, "The common market itself started under the inspiration of Catholic politicians, such as Adenauer of Germany, Paul Henry Spaak, Jean Monnet, Robert Schuman. They were all deeply influenced by Catholic social teaching. Monnet believed in the Catholic vision that Europe should become a federal superstate. The Financial Times wrote in 1995 that the idea of a united Europe has been viewed as essentially a Catholic concept. In 1976, the European calendar was changed." Now think of the little horn, saying that the little horn intended to change law and times. Now, of course, they had been changing that all along, the Catholic Church, that is, by doing away with the Sabbath, by saying Sunday had to replace the Sabbath, which is, of course, a lie. But even until 1976, when it comes to Europe, they had calendars, and the calendars showed very clearly that the Sabbath, Saturday, was the last day of the week, the seventh day of the week, and Sunday was the first day of the week. But not any longer. In 76, it was all changed. If you go to any store in Germany, wherever you want to go to, and you pick up a calendar, what you will see is that suddenly Sunday has become the last day of the week. A perfect example of utter deception. Now, the Bible reveals that the final revival of the ancient Holy Roman Empire will again be guided, will again be led by the Church of Rome. Now, the Bible speaks in several places of a heavenly queen, Himmelskönigin in German, which is being worshipped. That was true in ancient times, in ancient Judah, in ancient Israel, and you can look at this passage in Jeremiah chapter 7 and also in Jeremiah chapter 44. There is a queen of heaven who is being worshipped. Now, of course, the Bible condemns this practice. It's also that the modern city of Babylon, the modern Babylonian system, identifies herself as a queen. Notice this in Revelation chapter 18 and verse 7. Revelation 18 and verse 7. "In the measure that she glorified herself and lived luxuriously, in the same measure give her torment and sorrow, for she says in her heart, I sit as queen, and I am no widow, and will see no sorrow." And also in Isaiah chapter 45, you can look at this later, the reference is made to Babylon, modern Babylon, referring to herself as a queen. There it talks about the daughter of Babylon, which means the final revival. Now, is it a coincidence? We don't believe it is. That the design of the European flag was inspired by an image associated with the Virgin Mary. And Catholics refer to Mary as our mother, the Queen of Heaven, Our Lady, and the Queen of Europe. So the point is, the revival, the last revival of the European Empire, so to speak, was done under the direct directive of the Roman Catholic Church. And so now, let's go back now to Revelation 17 and verse 11 and read the portion in verse 12, which we haven't read yet. In verse 11, we read that the beast was, is not, and will be. But then we read in verse 11, "The beast that was and is not is himself also the eighth, and is of the seven, and is going to perdition." Now, how are we to understand that passage? The New Unger Bible's handbook explains it in this way. The last ruler of the revived empire is specified. Now, when it talks about the last ruler, it talks about the individual, the person. Verse 11 says, "And as for the beast which was and is not," talking about the revived empire, "even he," and they say the emphasis, "he himself," reference to a personal beast emperor, now coming into view, "even he is the eighth and is of the seventh," in other words, of the imperial, the government. And he goes into perdition. They say this diabolical head is unique. He rules over a 10-kingdom federation, unknown to imperial Roman governments, and makes war against the Lamb in the gigantic conflict of sovereignty over the earth. So you see, it's talking about the emperor and the empire, and he is becoming the eighth of the empire because it's slightly different from the empire. And the Nelson Study Bible agrees with that, saying the beast, now talking about the individual leader, is related to the seventh king, the seventh kingdom, the seventh revival, but he has also a separate identity because the power is being given to him by those 10 horns being part of the beast, the empire. Now we read, of course, in the book of Revelation, chapter 13, many other places, that Satan will give the beast his power. Now this talks about the empire and talks about the final leader of the empire. And in a sense, Satan gave his power to the entire history of the Roman Empire and all its leaders. And we also read that it's going to be the false prophet who is going to influence the people to worship the beast. Literally, worship the beast. In Revelation 13, let's notice verses 11 and 12. "Then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth." Now, this is talking about the Roman Catholic Church. "And he had two horns like a lamb," you know, pretending to be Christian, "and speaking like a dragon," being influenced by Satan, the devil, the dragon. "And he exercises all the authority of the first beast," that one with the seven heads, 10 horns, which would be revived 10 times, "in his presence, and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast," both the emperor and the empire, "whose deadly wound was healed." So this false prophet, the last representative of this religious organization, the little horn, will inspire, influence the people to worship ultimately the beast, meaning the final leader. Now this reminds of, it should remind us of the fact that Greek, Roman, and European leaders were literally worshipped and looked upon as God or a god. And this will also be true for the final military leader. For instance, it's well known that Hitler was perceived by many as the Messiah. Other leaders such as Charlemagne, Otto the Great, Napoleon, Mussolini, saw themselves as successors of the ancient Roman emperors who were deified. Mussolini in particular, as we have seen, was worshipped as a god by many Italians. What is also interesting, however, even though the beast will be worshipped himself, he will worship the false prophet, considering the false prophet as his god. Notice Daniel chapter 11. And again, we should see that close connection, this close collaboration between church and state and the leader of the state and the leader of the church. Daniel 11, verses 36 to 39. "Then the king," talking about here the beast, talking about that final leader of the ancient Roman Empire, the king shall do according to his own will. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god. But let's hold on. Shall speak blasphemies against the God of gods, the true God. Shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished. For what has been determined shall be done. He shall regard neither the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, maybe a reference to him being homosexual, nor regard any God, for he shall exalt himself above them all, up until this point. So in other words, he doesn't believe, it looks like, into the true God. Hitler didn't either. Hitler would talk about providence. He didn't believe in the God of Christianity, even the God of Christianity the way it was presented by the Catholic Church. He was determined to wipe out the concept of Christianity, replace it with paganism, completely and totally. But this goes on to say, but in their place, verse 38, he shall honor a god of fortresses. So he's going to honor somebody, a god of fortresses, and a god which his fathers did not know, he shall honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and pleasant things. And thus he shall act against the strongest fortresses with a foreign god, which he shall acknowledge and advance its glory. And he shall cause him to rule over many and divide the land for gain. Who is that foreign god? That foreign god whom his fathers didn't know. Well, of course, it is the false prophet. It is that final pope, who of course didn't exist at the time when his fathers lived, so they wouldn't have worshipped him, but he will. He will believe that the man of sin who's going to sit in the temple of God, who is still going to be built in Jerusalem prior to Christ's return, whether people accept that or not, he will believe that he is a god, and he will actually worship him, and he will follow him, and he will follow his lead, and this false prophet will tell him, okay, go and invade Jerusalem and take over that temple so I can sit in it. Again, this close collaboration between these two guys, and they both will be thrown into the lake of fire when Christ returns. Now, we should understand that Hitler was indeed demonically possessed. All of this is a terrible deception which happened under Hitler. And all of this will be a terrible deception, as it's going to happen in Europe very soon. Now, the demonic influence of Hitler affected and influenced those with whom he came in contact. I have a book here written by Klaus Fischer, Nazi Germany, A New History. Now, you can't get that book in bookstores any longer. People have tried. It's not going to be available anymore unless you find it in a bookstore with used books. To me, it is probably one of the best, if not the best, book I have ever written, about Nazi Germany. I'd like to quote a few things, and we quoted some of that in our booklet on European prophecy as well. There's an incident which was described when Hitler was 17 years old, and it says his only friend in Linz, that is in Austria, Gustl Kubitschek, reports that Adolf enjoyed speechifying for him while the two friends were walking through deserted fields, punctuating his orations with violent movements and vivid gestures. One night, after listening to Wagner's Rienzi, Hitler led his friend atop a steep hill where, with feverish excitement, he began speaking in a strange, raspy voice that did not seem to belong to him. According to Kubitschek, Hitler seemed possessed by his own demon. Now, of course, I use the Greek word for demon, but it means demon. And in a state of complete ecstasy and rapture, he transferred the character of Rienzi with visionary power to the plane of his own ambitions. This was the first time that Kubitschek had seen this aspect of Hitler's developing personality. By the way, I have the book which Kubitschek wrote, where he explains it even in more detail. Adolf's belief that he was singled out to play a providential role in world history must have sounded strange to his young friend. And we have seen there were leaders in Europe who had also the belief that they were playing a providential role in world history. And we have people right now not necessarily even in Europe only, who believes the same thing, that they are playing a providential role in world history. But let's not forget one thing. It is Satan who rules this world. The author here, Klaus Fischer, goes on to state, "It is well known that Hitler believed that he possessed the rare gift of prophetic sight and based some of his crucial decisions on this presumed insight. He sensed invisible demonic forces all around him. Hitler's anti-Semitism, Fischer tells us, went beyond prejudice. It was a psychopathology of a sort that must be ranked with witchcraft, remember that word, and demonology in the history of the human race." Now, we also are told that hundreds of people, and I just have another book at home, I just glanced at it this morning, but I didn't want to quote all of that from that book, literally hundreds of people testified to the fact that Hitler was not himself when he spoke, when he gives these public speeches. And so we say in here that hundreds of people have attested that the force of Hitler's personality could not only attract but convert those who fell under its spell. And Fischer reports about Hitler's hypnotic eyes. It says, "His eyes fascinated those who came under the influence. They were usually light blue with a faint tinge of greenish gray. Hitler himself confessed that he had inherited them from his mother, whose eyes he compared to those of the Greek Medusa, whose piercing glance could turn a man into stone." Now, I've just finished reading an interesting book which talks about the assassination of Robert Kennedy. And this also concluded that the one who allegedly killed Kennedy, Sirhan Sirhan, wasn't acting alone, that there were others who were also involved in the attack. There were too many bullets found. Now, we should know that, of course, Oswald wasn't the only one who killed John F. Kennedy. That has been pretty much established over the years. But here, what I found interesting is that apparently the same happened regarding to Robert Kennedy. But what is being claimed, that this guy, Sirhan Sirhan, who is still in prison, he was supposed to be released not too long ago, but the governor of California did not release him, that he was allegedly hypnotized to do the things which he then allegedly did, and he said he had absolutely no recollection later that he did any of that. So much when it comes to hypnosis. Now, Hitler made a remarkable statement in 1938 when British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain announced that he wanted to visit him. On September 13, Chamberlain dispatched a telegram to Hitler suggesting a personal meeting with the Führer in hopes of peacefully resolving the Czechoslovakian crisis. Now, this failed, as we know. Today, there are attempts to create a peaceful solution regarding the Russian-Ukrainian war, and the fear is that one is trying to appease Putin, as here Chamberlain was trying to appease Hitler. It didn't work then. It's not working now. But this article goes on to say, "The prospect of being visited by a British Prime Minister, 20 years his senior, making his first fight to see him, immensely appealed to Hitler's vanity. Ich bin vom Himmel gefallen. I fell from heaven," he reportedly exclaimed after receiving Chamberlain's telegram. Now, the interesting thing is this is not a common saying in German at all. It's virtually unknown to say it like that. You can say in German, ich bin aus allen Wolken gefallen. In other words, I fell out of all clouds, maybe. But not, ich bin vom Himmel gefallen. That is completely an unusual terminology, but there is one being who fell from heaven. Jesus Christ talks about him. He says, "I saw him," Satan the devil, "fall from heaven like lightning." Of course, you can read that in Luke chapter 10 and verse 18. So a very strong indication that it wasn't Hitler who spoke these words, or that he was at least inspired by the one who possessed him to say those words. Satan, the devil himself. The French ambassador later on would say about Hitler, "The same man, good-natured in appearance, sensitive to the beauties of nature, who across a tea table expressed reasonable opinions of European politics, and I might say when he invited specifically women, they were just absolutely impressed by his charisma. He was not a good-looking guy, by no means, but he had apparently charisma which was attractive to many women. He goes on to say, he was capable of the wildest frenzies, the most savage exaltation, and the most delirious ambition. This much is certain. He was no normal being. He was rather a morbid personality, a quasi-madman, a man possessed. And that is what he was. He himself called his invasion of Poland Teufelswerk, meaning the devil's work. Who inspired him to use those words? He was talking about his own actions, calling it and calling them the work of the devil. When it was all over, let's notice the state of affairs regarding the people of Germany. Karl Jaspers, a professor of philosophy, summed it up in this way. During the past 12 years, something has happened to us that seems like the remolding of our entire being. To put it in the form of an image, devils have been raining blows upon us and have swept us away, together with themselves, into a chaos which has robbed us of sight and hearing. We have experienced something like the witchcraft madness of the latter Middle Ages. It's a well-known fact that prior to World War II, those gurus in India lost all their powers. They couldn't do any more miracles, whatever miracles they are doing, right? And they were asked, well, what happened to you? And they said, all our powers went to Europe. It's also a well-known fact that Hitler and his henchmen were able to locate submarines of the quote-unquote enemy, the Americans, the British. And they should not have known that kind of understanding, that kind of knowledge. And so the Americans and the British actually thought there must be a spy involved here, a German spy working amongst us, telling Hitler and those under him where those submarines were. Until it was later found, no, it was inspiration. These guys suddenly got the inspiration. They suddenly knew where those submarines were. Now you can figure out yourself who gave them that kind of inspiration. And so the point is that the final revival of the Roman Empire will be ruled quite literally by demons. And we see this developing right now as we speak. Notice Revelation chapter 16, verses 13 and 14. Revelation 16 and verse 13. I saw three unclean spirits like frogs coming out of the mouth of the dragon, Satan the devil. So he is sending powerful demons directly. And out of the mouth of the beast, so in other words, that's the end time ruler. He is possessed by a demon, maybe by Satan himself, or by another very powerful demon. And out of the mouth of the false prophet. He is also possessed. And remember now, it's going to be the man of sin who is going to sit in the temple of God, claiming to be God. He is doing mighty signs and wonders. He's doing it with the power and the influence of Satan the devil, as 2 Thessalonians clearly points out. It goes on to say, for they are, verse 14, spirits of demons, performing signs, which go out to the kings of the earth and of the whole world to gather them to the battle of that great day of God Almighty. So they will try to influence all of them to come to Jerusalem to fight against Christ. But they have those demons already before they inspire those people to come to Jerusalem. Can you imagine they are making these signs, and specifically the false prophets? I mean, Hitler didn't make any signs, and people worshipped him. Mussolini didn't make any signs, people worshipped him. Here these guys are making signs and wonders, lying signs of wonders. Can you imagine the reaction? The reaction will be awful. And only those who are inspired by God, the true God of the Bible, will be able to understand. Revelation chapter 18 and verse 2. Now this talks about the ultimate fate of this Babylonian system, but It's also describing the situation of the Babylonian system now. It says, "And he cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen, and has become a dwelling place of demons, a prison of every foul spirit, and a cage for every unclean and hated bird." This final revival will be complete and utterly in the hands of demons, in the hands of the beast and the false prophets, who themselves are being led by Satan the devil. And it goes so far that people will actually worship the demons. Now, they may not know. The Germans might not have known that Hitler, whom they worshipped, was inspired by demons. They were deceived. But notice Revelation chapter 9, verses 20 and 21. Revelation 9, verse 20. "But the rest of mankind who were not killed by these plagues," now these are plagues which God himself is going to pour out on the people to bring them to repentance, "they didn't repent of the works of their hands, that they should not worship demons and the idols of gold, silver, brass, stone, and wood, which can neither see nor hear nor walk. And," verse 21, "they did not repent of their murders or their sorceries or their sexual morality or their thefts." Interesting, the word for sorceries here is associated with drugs. And it can be also described as enchantment with drugs. Now, we're not necessarily talking about that all this is referring to are the taking of drugs. The word pharmacy, by the way, comes from the Greek word, which is being used here. But you see, the results are pretty much the same. I mean, you take drugs, you become somebody who is not somebody who is in control of himself or herself. The same when demons take over. And of course, you take drugs and you open yourself up to demonic influence, to be sure. And they didn't repent of that. They were happy with their kind of a lifestyle. And they didn't repent of their sorcery, as we read. Notice Revelation chapter 17, when it comes to the destruction of modern Babylon. It says, "The kings of the earth have committed fornication," especially with that woman riding the beast, "and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of a fornication." In other words, they accepted those false teachings. Also in verse 13. No, in verse 18. "And the woman whom you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth," I mean built on seven hills, Rome. And the question is, how is that possible? How are they being deceived? How are they being drunk with the wine of her fornication? How and why would they accept that? Why would they accept that? Notice Revelation 18, verse 23. "The light of a lamp shall not shine in you anymore, and the voice of bridegroom and bride shall not be heard in you anymore. For your merchants were the great men of the earth, for by your sorcery all the nations were deceived." By your sorcery. To be even more precise, what kind of sorcery are we talking about here? Let's read as the last scripture now, Isaiah chapter 47, because here the final destruction of the Babylonian system, a collaboration between church and state, is described in Isaiah 47 and verse 9. We read this. "But these two things shall come to you in a moment, in one day, and Babylon," it is being referred to in the book of Revelation as a system which will be destroyed in one day, in one hour even. "For in one day the loss of children and widowhood, they shall come upon you in their fullness because of the multitude of your sorceries," the multitude of your sorceries, "and for the great abundance of your enchantments. And here, the word for sorcery is the word for witchcraft. And if you read the history of many of the popes, you find that they were heavily engaged and involved in witchcraft. And so will the last one be. And so will the beast be. And so was Hitler. And so were others. It's all going to be completely under the rule of Satan and his demons. And we should understand that. Because only God can help us when this time has arrived. Only when we have God's Spirit leading us, directing us, guiding us, showing us the truth, will we understand who that beast is, who that false prophet is, and how we can escape their evil influence. Most people will not be able or willing to do that. You have a chance to do it because you know the truth. Don't forget about it.